Thank you, Aaron and Madeline, for that beautiful prelude. Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. My name is Christina Clock, and I am a member of Prairie. I am happy to be here this morning as your program facilitator. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age, or your abilities, or your inabilities. Toward the end of the service, we invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by our minister, Ralph Tiksinski. Today, our program will be presented by Professor John Hawks. Professor Hawks will be discussing scientific education and the scientific public. I will have the honor of introducing him later in the program. Our opening words this morning will be provided by Dean Schroeder and Phyllis Wong.
We'll start with excerpts from the principles of the UUA. We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote, among other things, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. The living tradition which we share draws from many sources, including direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder affirmed in all cultures, which moves us to a renewal of the spirit and an openness to the forces which create and uphold life, and humanist teachings which counsel us to heed the guidance of reason and the results of science and warn us against idolatries of the mind and spirit.
Faith is a fine invention when gentlemen can see, but microscopes are prudent in an emergency.
Please turn to our first song, A Fierce Unrest, number 304 in Singing the Living Tradition. Please stand as you are able.
Thank you.
As we now light the chalice, let us join our voices together in Prairie's bond of union. We, the members of Prairie, wish to associate ourselves together in a religious community which affirms that we share a common humanity, that we need one another, and that our futures are inescapably bound together. Together, we would expand our intellectual horizons, enrich our sensory experiences, and deepen our emotional sensitivities. We would sharpen our ethical awareness and broaden our sense of social responsibility. We would stand tall in our quest for integrity of life, yet not at others' expense. It stretches out until it becomes one with the sky. Let us reach out to touch and be one with the natural world and with one another. Let us enter a time of silence. As a caring community, we now take this time to briefly share special joys, sorrows, or personal concerns with our Prairie friends. And Kim has the mic.
I have a joy. Last blood drive we had, we exceeded the pledge. We had pledged 30 pints, and we had 38. In fact, people were standing in line to give more when they had to stop because there's another meeting in that room.
I had the joy of going out to Seattle last weekend to attend my brother and sister-in-law's 50th anniversary party, and it was a wonderful trip. The difficulty was that my brother's symptoms from both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are getting worse.
It was a joy this last week. Our daughter Kate was admitted to a PhD program in chemistry at UW-Madison.
After 2 years of trying, we finally sold a chunk of our forest land, and that's good news on two fronts. Number one, we can actually pay our pledge. And number two, the people who bought our land are going to continue the sustainable forestry that we've been doing for 30-some years, so we're proud of that.
Okay.
Well, I'll let you.
I guess as the youngest members of this organization, I'm pleased to tell you that my wife and I are celebrating our 56th wedding anniversary.
Oh. Thank you, everyone. I now have the honor of introducing our presenter for today. Complex scientific issues are increasingly part of public policy debates and individual futures. Climate change, alternative fuels, genetic modification, routine mammograms, genetic testing, each is a topic driven by scientific inquiry, presenting opportunities for technological solutions, but demanding public awareness. How can we cultivate a culture of aware citizens, informed consumers, and entrepreneurs ready to invest or work in scientific fields? Can education policy advance these goals? Professor John Hawks has been an associate professor of anthropology at UW-Madison since 2002. He teaches a range of courses from the introductory to the graduate level. In his research, he investigates human evolution in its morphological and genetic aspects. Professor Hawks, welcome to Prairie.
Well, I'd like to thank you for inviting me and thank everyone for listening. I'm listening to those words that I put down as what I was going to talk about and thinking, my goodness, I've set out quite an agenda for myself. Last year, a group of people interested in science education policy put out a paper in the journal Evolution Education and Outreach that listed every state and gave them a grade in terms of their science education, and in particular biology education state standards. Wisconsin on this scale earned a D. That puts us in the auguste company of Alaska, Kentucky, and Tennessee. It does put us ahead of West Virginia and Oklahoma. Kansas, I'm from Kansas, so I get sensitive about this. Kansas in 2000, the last time they did this survey, earned an F minus. In 2009, the Kansas State Science Standards earned an A. So it is quite possible to turn around your state standards and change them. I bring that out as a point because it's a real good takeaway. You know, this is something people should know, is that Wisconsin is not in the forefront of biology education nationwide. I've taught human evolution in four states. I started in Kansas. I taught in Michigan. I taught in Utah. Utah on this scale earns an A. I taught in Wisconsin. And I will say that at my university level teaching introductory biology courses, so kids who are coming out of high school biology, Wisconsin is the lowest in terms of the students that I see. So that's really, you know, where I'm coming from as a university educator and also as a scientist. And so when I think about science and public policy, which is one thing that scientists really, you know, feel like we can inform on, and also education standards, I think about my experiences there. I also think about my experiences as an outreach writer. I have a website. It's the fancy name is John Hawk's Weblog, and I write about human evolution and genetics. I write about my work and my field. I tend to write every day. It's grown over time. This last month was my biggest month in 5 years of writing, and I have about 7,000 visitors every day. So from 190 different domains, which are mostly countries, although the United States, you've got NETS and COMS and EDUs, but they're international, really worldwide, my readers, a lot of them from Wisconsin, a lot of them from every other state. And that's an outreach effort, something I do to help educate the public. I keep my own notes on things. And so a lot of times people come to my site, they see a point of view about my science, anthropology, human genetics, in a way that they wouldn't get from the media. I hear from people a lot of times. The thing that I hear that's maybe the strangest, and I would just write it off, except I've gotten 5 letters like this over the years, is people who are writing me with a confession. I think they always start the same way. You're going to think I'm some sort of crank, but I think my husband is a Neanderthal. It's almost always, I think my husband is. It's never, I think my wife is, although I did have one guy who wrote and said, I think I may be a. They always describe the right characteristics, you know, unusual amounts of body hair, this prominent brow, all this sort of thing, you know, hunched, stooped. I always explain that, you know, actually, you know, there's nothing impossible about Neanderthal genes still being around, but the stereotype that you describe, you know, is not necessarily scientifically accurate. So there's a lot of interest out there in what I do. It's interest that more often comes when we have a new discovery. This afternoon I'll talk about Ardipithecus, and I've got a lot of readers for Ardipithecus. But it's It's also having to do with the way that we're using new technologies, and in particular new technologies in genetics, to learn about the past, and the way that we use them to learn about our own lives. I have a lot of people who read who are very interested in genealogy. Today, genetics has become a pathway of getting information about your genealogy for people who may not know their family histories, for adoptees who may not know their origins. You know, people are using genetics for this. It's a way that science is addressing individual histories, individual lives. We also, of course, in the last few months, have had big news stories about climate change and the misbehavior or ways that people think that scientists have misbehaved in presenting climate change information. And I'm not a climate scientist, so, you know, the ins and outs of this are not especially my, you know, forte. But I'll tell you that looking at the ways that this debate has gone on and the ways that the maybe discussion between openness in science, sharing scientific data, these are things that come out in my field quite often. Ardipithecus is a find that has tremendous public interest. And it's a find that I will not, in the foreseeable future, be able to study data from, because of policies or lack thereof about scientific data gathering and data sharing. So there are, you know, real concerns in science today about how you share data, how you present your data to the public, and what responsibilities you have as a scientist. So, to start off, what do we want science education to do? I mean, the broad topic, science education. What do we want to accomplish with science education? And I sort of outlined three possible answers, and there are, of course, others. One possible goal is we want to make tomorrow's generation of scientists. You know, we want to educate people, kids, so that they're equipped to make contributions to science in the future. Another possible goal is we want science to inform public policy. And since we live in a democracy, a democratic republic, we want people to be informed about science so that they can vote in ways that policymakers will respond to scientific accuracy as they're making decisions. So that's a possible goal, public policy that's informed. And another possible goal is we want people to be equipped to make decisions for themselves. We want them to be able to use scientific methods or information when they're deciding about health treatments, or when they're deciding to purchase products from companies, when they're deciding to use their property. You know, those are the sorts of things we want people to be able to use a scientific background to address. So I want to say a few words about each of these in terms of examples to see if there's anything that we can bring away from our goals that will inform us about what education should be like. More scientists. Do we want to educate the next generation of scientists? Do we want to have more and better scientists in the future? Better is always good. I have no argument against that. But one response to the argument that we want more scientists in the future is that we've got too many already. It is really hard to break into a scientific career today. The average time between finishing your PhD and moving into a tenure track position, you know, something where you have real job security as a scientist, the average time is 3 years. Most of the time, people are on postdocs in that time period, which are sort of, you know, very subsistence level pay for people who are coming at this with often 5 to 7 years of postgraduate education. Scientists are paid less for education level than any other profession. So from the standpoint of supply and demand, it's fairly clear that we have more scientists now than we have demand for scientists. And it's led to competition. Now, one possible answer is that, well, we're not providing enough money for science. We need to pay people more. But on the other hand, science is a really attractive career. There are reasons why people are willing to go into this and do it at lower than average pay levels for their amount of education. It's rewarding. Figuring out things is fun. You know, there's a real aspect to this that, you know, people like to be scientists. I love it. I'm not worried about how much I'm making. If I were making a lot less, I'd worry. But It's not my primary concern. But it does affect whether people, young people at the university level, are making decisions to go into science. It's a certain kind of person who goes into science. It's not just everybody. It's not a field that's easy to get a family started early. It's not a field that has become especially friendly to families in a lot of cases. And that has effects on the output in terms of science. It also has effects on the willingness of scientists to engage in education. Another thing is it has effects on scientists' behavior in terms of sort of career protection behaviors, what I call guild enforcing behaviors. It's very hard to break into science through any route other than the usual route. I have a friend, a very close friend, who's worked with me on many scientific papers, who is, he's a physicist by training, but his interests recently have been especially anthropological and evolutionary. He's written 2 books in the area of evolutionary biology. He's prominent in terms of the papers that he's written get a lot of attention. And he has the great disadvantage that he wasn't trained as a biologist and is 53 years old. He cannot get into biology as a career. That's a move that cannot now be made. He's supporting himself on a very large grant at the moment from a private individual who has a foundation that supports people like him, but this is very unusual. You know, we're talking about somebody who's made contributions that are important, you know, but are non-typical. And that means that in some sense, science is closed to people who come from outside its guild structure, which is an item of concern, especially when we think about the way that we want science to be in the public's view. We want to have an open science, because science is an open procedure. Ideas are rare, which means that one strategy for getting more ideas is to broaden the number of people who are throwing them out there. Today, the public is more equipped than at any time in the past to actually contribute to scientific endeavors. And this is mostly because of technology. We have technology, the internet, that allows us to communicate over long distances easily, to publish in very specialized venues, but then make those publications available to the world. And that's increasingly being done with open access scientific journals, with individual scientists sharing their reprints freely on their own websites, sometimes in violation of copyright laws. We tend not to care so much. I care because I run this prominent website, right? I never do this because I figure if they're going to come after anybody, it'll be me first. But also because of the technology that we have for generating data. Sometime in the next couple of years, a new telescope is coming online called the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope. This telescope has the equivalent, I'm gonna get the number wrong, but I believe it's the equivalent of 64. It's gotta be more than that. It's a large number of digital camera sensors that are at the base of this. And the digital camera sensors that are all put out in a giant array churn out terabytes of data every night. Last year, I got the chance to meet the guy who's building this thing, who's in charge of figuring out what to do with all these data. And he said to me, I always hear that, you know, biologists are complaining that their field is becoming all, you know, data processing, that there's all these data that people are using and generating. I've got to tell you, this is nothing compared to what we deal with. You know, all of these data generated by this telescope, because of the sponsorship of some of the guys who run Microsoft and a number of other foundations and the NSF, all of these data will be downloadable from the internet for free. It seems to me that if you were running a high school class about astronomy, that you could use these data to do real science. My own experience with this sort of data access, data sharing situation is from genetics. The Human Genome Project, Bill Clinton finished it, right? So it's all gone. And after that, of course, the geneticists didn't go away. So they said, what are we going to do next? The next thing that they decided to do was to survey variability in the genome. I mean, the genome is a draft that represents what an average human DNA would be like. But what's important about it, if we want to figure out what causes disease, or if we want to figure out where people came from in the past, which is my interest, what we want to know is how people vary. So the next thing that they did, and the next rational development from the standpoint of genetic technology, was to find sites in the human genome that vary. To design a microchip that you could run somebody's cheek swab on and would light up on genotypes that vary between individuals and create a catalog of variation for individuals from different populations. The first phase of that was completed in 2003. It's called the International HapMap, which is short for haplotype map. Haplotype is a genetic type that goes across many different genetic sites, genotypes. The International HapMap today encompasses 3.9 million genetic variants, genotypes that people are different at, in 13 populations in the world. All of these data, the original data, the source data from the microchips, the processed data, the phasing data that shows you the actual what a person's chromosome looks like who has this, all of these data are available for free download to anybody who wants them. I know that a high school class dealing with genetics can do real science with this because I'm doing real science on it. That's nothing that I can't get high school students to do. So it's really created a new environment in science where the data to do real stuff is available to anybody. What's rare is the knowledge to do stuff with it. Well, from the standpoint of education, we want some public rationale. Why do we want to change education? One possible public rationale is we want to make more informed policy decisions. I think that policy and openness go hand in hand. And one of the reasons why the climate change story, scandal, whatever you call it, has really reached a peak in the last couple of months is this concern about whether people are sharing their methods, this concern about whether the methods are available for inspection. And there's a whole debate about, well, who is it that wants to inspect these data? They just want to go in and find something that's wrong so that they can argue that the whole enterprise is wrong. The fact is, in science, you have to be willing to put up or shut up. I mean, this is stuff that if you can't show what you did, then what you did is not replicable. And in my field, in human evolution, we have fossils that exist that I've touched that have been scanned so that you can have CT scans to look at the internal structure of them. You can look at things like growth lines in the teeth, all of this stuff. Sometimes, in rare cases, these are available to me. In most cases, they aren't. Which means that if somebody publishes on them, they're not replicable. I can't look at this and independently say that this is correct. They followed the right procedure. And the important part of science is not that we figure out clever things. The important part of science is that anybody can figure out the clever thing for themselves. It's verifiable. If you follow the same thing, you can get it yourself. One of the important things about policy decisions is this sort of conflict between individuals' interests, individuals' ability to wall off their stuff, the government's ability to promote the interests of some individuals over others, and the public's ability to inspect. We've seen that outside of scientific context, for instance, voting machines. One of the big problems with voting machines is, can you inspect the code? Do you know that somebody's not substituting other people's votes for your own? One strategy is to make the code secret so that, well, nobody could break into it. But of course, somebody can always break into things. The question is whether the knowledge to break into them is spread widely or the code is inspectable so that you can go back and make sure that it's secure, or if it's insecure, so that you at least know it, so you know the strategies you can use to help to prevent these sorts of break-ins. It's the same thing with science. We're not talking about security as often, although security is one branch of this. we are talking about whether we can find the right answers to things. Individual decision making. I think this is maybe the best argument for good science education, because companies are out there selling products. There are companies now that would like to sell you diet plans based on your genetics. So you send them a cheek swab, they send you a diet plan. You're type X. There's a guy that will be happy to sell you a book that tells you, if you're blood type A, you should be eating this. Because blood type A originated at the time of the origins of agriculture. And before, so it's adapted to wheat agriculture. But this is all a crock. I've got to tell you. The blood type diet sort of especially irritates me. Because blood type A is the ancestral blood type, and O originated something like 3.3 million years ago. We know this. This isn't mysterious information. But it's information that is not super easily accessible. It's easy for somebody to make claims without being rebutted in maybe equally prominent ways. Today, or this last week, I asked my students, there's a new genetic test. This is a real genetic test. This isn't a crock genetic test. The nutrigenomics people will take your cheek swab and not do anything with it and then tell you what you should be eating. The government was after them a couple of years ago for this. Genetics companies like 23andMe. 23andMe is a company where you send your cheek swab and they'll tell you 360,000 genotypes that you have. They're using one of these chips. And we could use those data to look at the histories of populations, to look at associations between physical characteristics, behaviors, and disease. 23andMe is investigating the, we'd call them phenotypes, but what it is your health records or your behaviors. Are you an athlete? Do you participate in, are you a 10K runner? They're looking at that sort of thing and seeing if there are genotypes that correlate with it. That's science. They're collecting this on a large sample of their customers. Well, there's another company called Counsyl. I know some of the guys who founded this company. I'm not involved with them, but I happen to know the example. And this week, or last week, they made public their new genetic test. They will screen your DNA for carrier states for autosomal recessive genetic diseases. So, do you carry cystic fibrosis? One in 40, Americans do. 1 in 40 Americans means that if you mate with somebody else who has cystic fibrosis, well, there's basically there's a 1 in 40 chance that you mate with somebody who carries it. The chances that your two carrier genes will come together and have a CF positive offspring is 1 in 1,600. This is not super common, but it is one of the most common genetic disorders in the U.S. They're testing for 100 of them simultaneously. Now, there's nothing super difficult about that either. The state of Wisconsin will test your baby, your newborn baby, for 50 genetic disorders. And there's a point to doing this. Some genetic disorders, like phenylketonuria, PKU, if you detect it early enough, you can do things that will help prevent the disease's onset. So you can make dietary changes in the case of PKU so that the disease progression is not as bad. Wisconsin tests for 50. Counsyl will test people, couples, especially right now, couples who are engaged in IVF fertilization or other kinds of reproductive technologies, will test them in advance, so that they know whether they're carriers. Now, from the standpoint of public understanding of science, I asked my students this week, how many of you would be willing to pay for that? They want to know, how much is it? Is it thousands of dollars? It's $349 each. So $700 a couple. Compared to the cost of IVF, of course, this is very minor. Especially if it causes couples to decide to do, embryo screening to see if they want, to see the genotypes of possible implants. That's the story. This is something that you can pull out of your pocket and buy. It's something that insurance companies today are deciding whether or not to pay for. Insurance companies save money when you don't have kids. So from the standpoint of individual decision-making, a question is, what realistically are the risks? What realistically are the costs? What realistically are the prospects for future technology changes that will also impact this area? Should you decide to go ahead and have kids now if you have this test? Or should you wait for 10 years to see if some new technology has come along? These are the kinds of things that kids today learning science, these are the decisions they'll need to be able to make in 10 to 15 years. And so when I think about science education, I'm thinking about how do we equip kids to make those decisions for themselves. Now, when we look at biology education, just to turn this back to education, we look at biology education, we have a couple of questions. So I started off with Wisconsin earns a D. Why? What is it that we're doing wrong? It turns out we're not doing wrong what some states are. What Texas does wrong is they have a really good basic biology education, and then at the end of it they say, but all of this could be false because really, you know, a creationist explanation could be true. You know, that's one kind of bad thing you could do, you know, sort of undermine your message. Wisconsin does not do that. Wisconsin state standards are basically weak in the adjunct areas to evolutionary biology. The part that I'm interested in is evolution. But to understand evolution, you need to know how that connects to other kinds of science. You need to know how it connects to the changes of the universe over time. How has the universe progressed from galaxy formation to star formation to the elements that biological systems are made out of? Where does life come from, ultimately? Wisconsin is not very good at distinguishing the methods of historical science. When we look at the past to explain things, we can't run experiments. We can't replay history. We have to be able to explain how we can learn about past events by looking at outcomes in the present and by looking at repeated cases of things in many instances. There's no presentation of human evolution in Wisconsin, and I'm sort of sad about that. But this is the sort of thing that we really don't do well. In other words, we don't integrate across the science curriculum. It's this kind of integration I think is important. Putting together science with other kinds of inquiry. Making people understand why science has informed our history, and making us understand historical events with scientific processes that have gone on alongside them. You can't understand the history of the Industrial Revolution without understanding something about the scientific developments that caused it and that it engendered. And if you want to train engineers, you need them to understand how these processes have unfolded. So from my point of view, the way that we change science education, and certainly one way that would address these standards, is to make it integrated. Make people understand how it goes together with everything else. I'm very happy to say that my kids are, we live in Verona, my kids are in the New Century School, and this year they've made the decision to go to an integrated environmental curriculum for the future, where they'll be learning about science integrated with their reading, integrated with literacy, integrated with math, integrated with everything that they do. And of course, in the state of Aldo Leopold, I think that's a really appropriate way to try to drive this sort of education. But it's not the only way. And when we look beyond the elementary level to the high school level, I think there's every chance of getting people really involved in science much earlier because of the advances that we've had in terms of technology, in terms of access. I think I've used my time. And I'll stop there and take a couple of questions, I think. And thanks for listening. Yeah.
Stop me if you addressed this while I was dealing with kids, but can you comment at all on the citizen science concept and maybe talk about ways people could involve themselves with that?
I think, you know, I think this is really the wave of the future. When we think about the efforts that really get people excited right now, you know, things like bioblitzing, where you get a bunch of people together and go through an area and count every species that's there and collect basically original data about observations of species at a given point in time. The real, from my point of view, citizen science is figuring out the histories behind genes. We've got, my work is on genetic changes that have unfolded in the last 30,000 years in human evolution. We've got a bunch of genes, it turns out to be something like 1,800, that are rapidly evolving in different human populations. Each of those genes has a story, and we don't understand all the stories. But what we desperately need, the kind of work that I do, is to put together times, places, and history so that we can say that this population was making the transition to agriculture at this point in time. And that involved changes in ecology in terms of disease and in terms of diet. And to match potential candidate genes that might have changed under those influences. This is something that anybody can do. And I know a number of people outside of institutional science who are working on it. And that kind of effort also is a citizen science sort of thing. Yeah, so I think it's great. Yes?
My question for you has to do with being able to make educated decisions about your health or what you eat. There are constantly studies that are being done that are being supported by big pharmaceutical companies or big food companies. And, you know, lo and behold, the results of their studies are always, you know, well, this food that we make is a superfood kind of thing. How much of an influence is there on the quality of the science that's being done if the funding is coming from the people who have a great deal of stake in what those results are? I mean, how can we truly trust the results of these studies that are telling us things about what we should do when the people who want to sell us something as a result of it are behind it?
My attitude as a skeptic is trust no one. But ultimately, that's a very nihilistic attitude. You know, if I can't trust what somebody's telling me, you know, I can't investigate everything myself. And I'm somebody who's equipped to investigate a lot of these claims. But I can't do it all myself. And so what do we need in those situations? What we need is a recognition that, you know, first of all, transparency. You want to know who the funding sources are. We often have that. I mean, a scientific study that's published by people who are funded by the NIH, funded by NSF, funded by a private corporation, they're required for publication to list those things, to list possible conflicts of interest. So we sort of know. But what we don't have really easily is the ability to say, and that means that they put their thumb on the scale here. I talked last fall to a guy at the University of Washington who was involved in investigating the Pfizer Vioxx mess. In that case, one of the real tragic things was that they knew long in advance of making any information public that there was a problem. And what they wanted to do, I think, rationally, was to investigate the problem, make sure that this isn't a false positive. But even after the data began to come in to say that there's a real problem here, you know, there's a resistance to push forward on it. That resistance, it's what we'd call maybe a policy resistance. From the standpoint of a company, policy is about profits and stockholders. From the point of view of governments, policy is about people who are invested in governments, lobbyists, public's constituencies. But policy concerns always make it difficult to outline, you know, how much confidence do you have to have in a result from a scientific point of view to say, yes, we absolutely must act on it. That's a problem that is in some sense insoluble because it's going to differ for every possible perspective. If an asteroid is hurtling toward the Earth, we would say that, you know, we don't have we're not 100% confident that it's going to strike us, but if there's a 30% chance, we better get some rockets up there. You know, whereas 30% chance of something else, you know, 30% chance of extinction of some very small insect species in some very remote place in Alaska, you would say, well, 30% is 30%. So because policy, I mean, that's the part where hopefully science will inform policy, but we have to recognize that policy decisions aren't science. I have a friend who said, you know, if it was my dad who had been taking Vioxx and died, I'd have gone to their headquarters with a gun. So it's that level of, you know, people. You see CSI. Everybody understands that, right? I get students every year who come into my office saying, I really want to do forensic anthropology. And I say, you understand there's no jobs in this. But what one of the things that's happened, CSI is not alone. There's the Big Bang Theory, this show. There's all kinds of Mythbusters. There's shows that show that scientists are people. And in some sense, that shouldn't be a surprising message. You know, you go away from the lab and you've got personal problems. But on the other hand, I think it helps to remind us, it helps to remind me. When I was a graduate student in the 90s, the big topic in human evolution was the recent out of Africa theory. And my lab was, my advisor's lab, was a real multi-regional kind of lab. So we were, you know, looking at genetic data very skeptically. It was our job. These are the Clinton years, and I like to call this the war room, because a new paper would come out, and genetics disproves everything that you ever knew before. And it was our job to read through it before anybody else had, to have responses. Here are the talking points. Here's what we've got. And that was a really exciting way to do science, to say, we understand this paper. We read it. We know what the weaknesses are. We can present those weaknesses to journalists to tell them, this is how we respond to this. And there was something very productive about that. You know, we moved our understanding forward. We shifted our position to say, well, we have to have an explanation that also accounts for these data, so we have to shift it in this way. But it also shows you how easy it is to get into this mindset of, you know, they're skeptical of us, they're publishing something critical about us, and we have to reject them. We have to show that they're idiots. And there's a real fine line in politics and in science. You know, at that level, science is politics.
And on the other hand, though, 160 years, 50 years after Darwin, 90 years after the Scopes trial, I don't remember the exact number, something like 60% of the people don't believe in the validity of the theory of evolution. People have, obviously, in terms of the aggregation of which belief systems people operate on, the vast majority are seeking to sustain a previous social structure and not adapt to conditions. And I mentioned that because I wonder whether, well, there's nothing wrong with curricula improvements. I wonder whether, because I play in my professional life, I play in the climate change sandbox, and I get even more dispirited than you do. I wonder if the emphasis should be on understanding the human mind and how it works, and the evolution provides the best basis for that, because we don't meet new conditions by making a new creature. We jury-rig all the prior developments that occurred before. So we co-inhabit all these different things in our mind. And it seems to me we need to better understand primal impulses that result from that concatenation in our own minds.
Well,
that makes science so irrelevant to the vast majority of the people that govern the policies that make the scientific discoveries wither on the vine.
Society is hard to change.
Okay.
But I also like to bring to mind some successes. In the 1930s, bad farming practices in my state, Kansas and Texas and Oklahoma and eastern Colorado, created the Dust Bowl. This was, you know, people were doing what they'd been taught to do, what they'd been doing for generations. It didn't work when the rain went away and created tremendous environmental problems. After that, or during that, I should say, the federal government implemented effective sort of, say, educational changes for farmers. know, here's how you farm in a more sustainable way, in a way that's going to conserve the soil. We called it conservation. And they implemented contour plowing. They implemented terraces, fallowing your land, you know, having an extension agent come out and see what parts of your land are suitable for different purposes. There were new insurance schemes so that you had, you know, you didn't have to farm things out all the time. You had the ability to plant something that was maybe on average more sustainable and insure it if the crop failed. You know, all of these changes were implemented. They were implemented at the level of grade school and high school science curricula. So when I was in grade school in Kansas, we learned soil conservation. You know, we learned about all this stuff. We learned it at that level. And the kids who I went to school with, who ultimately became farmers, they're practicing it. That's a real science education success. It's not sexy. It's not, you know, rocket science. But it's something that has made a tremendous difference to the economy and to the environment of the Midwest. So it's that kind of applied science that I think we have real successes with. And of course, there are always going to be policy things in science that, you know, it's harder to see how you integrate this into a curriculum. How are we going to integrate genomics into high school curricula? But I'll tell you, high schools for the past many years, I don't know if any of you have been involved in high schools are extracting DNA from cells. You know, they're breeding fruit flies. They do this stuff. So it's, you know, how do you create the situation where this becomes a part of everybody's education?
Okay. I don't know whether you've read Chris Mooney's Scientific Illiteracy, but in that book he sort of bemoans the death of science journalists and suggests that some of the scientists be transferred into science journalism. I don't know.
Well, you know, I'm somebody who writes for the public. And you may ask, why do you do it? I often tell young folks starting out in science, graduate students and so on, you know, there's sort of two ways to move up in science, to do the work that you want to do. And one way is to do work that's publicly engaging, that brings you attention, that, you know, gets people into your lab, gets people interested in what you're doing. And the other way is to go through the standard sort of grant application, you know, do the things that the other people want you to do the things that you know, grant applications are infamous for. If you want to get the grant funded, you write down work that you've already done, so that you know the results already, and then you send it off, and they give you money for that, and you use that money to do the thing you didn't know. But these are two very different mechanisms. And what maybe needs to be done is to have a recognition that scientists, we should demand more out of them. And one of the things about science is that, I mentioned, there's too many of them.
Two questions.
Yeah.
Short one. What was the ratio of pros and cons to your net, on your net, talking about evolution, pro and con evolution? Second one was, since our sun is very slowly evolving, is there any discussion of the effects on the Earth of the slow evolution of the sun?
I'll take the first one first. It was a proud day when the first time I had a creationist site say noted evolutionist John Hawks, even noted evolutionist John Hawks claims that X. Yeah, so in some perspective, if you're publicly known in biology or evolutionary biology especially, yeah, you have to be able to, you have to be ready for folks who are really engaged with creationism to, you know, obviously, they're going to show an interest in your work if you're prominent. They're going to try to, use words against you. On the other hand, it's hard to take that too seriously. You know, if people are not serious themselves, we can say, but they can have bad effects. They can do bad things. They're out there doing terrible stuff to our kids, to our science education. Yeah, but that kind of critique is sort of laughable. What I find interesting is that you know, I look in the creationist journals every so often. They're getting better. They're using genetics in ways that are real. You know, they're wrong. You know, they start from a flawed premise to come to their result, but they make good critiques. Climate science. Here's an area where people, climate scientists, have been publishing on a model for a long time, and in recent years, you've got some people, some avocational scientists, folks who are not, you know, who are retired or not employed as scientists, who do completely different things, making real critiques. You could say that their assumptions may be flawed, or they may not find the error that brings the whole edifice tumbling down. But we need more people like this. What we need to do is engage rather than divorce. You know, we need to make those critiques count for us, because that's, you know, looking for truth is what it's about. It's not about, you know, building yourself up.
A quick question about the process of scientific discovery. I always get a little disturbed when I hear people that maybe have not had a very good education in the scientific method, that, oh, that's only a theory. That's only a theory, and we still have to find the facts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there's a big confusion that people have between theories and facts and mm-hmm. hypotheses and how they're all related. And if you could talk about that for a few minutes. As your facilitator, I have to say we have time for one more question after this one.
Okay. Only a theory. Yeah. How do we figure stuff out? Let me give you an example. We know from anthropology that there are a lot of people in from history, that there's a lot of people in the world now, and not so long ago, in geological terms, 10,000 years ago, there were a lot less people. And all of this has happened because we invented a new food production method, agriculture, that enabled our population to grow. Well, suppose that I approach this knowledge, which comes maybe from outside of science in some sense, although we have science that contributes to it, that deepens our understanding of it. We know where people lived. We know where they were moving stuff. We can look at the dynamics of those populations. Suppose I look at this situation and said, what do I expect about their evolution? We know there's a lot more of them. What do I expect to be true about the genetic changes in this population? So here's a very practical, applied instance that applies to humans. What do I expect? Some people say, well, if there's a lot of food now, then, and you've started living in cities, you don't have to move around as much anymore. What we should expect is that they shouldn't, you know, evolution should stop. They don't need anything anymore. Things should be, you know, they're replaced evolution with cultural changes. So if they need to change, they learn how to do things differently. There's no way that evolution could happen on that rate. That was really an accepted view in anthropology until a few years ago. It was something that Darwin didn't say this, but the other guy who invented natural selection, Wallace, did. Evolution should have stopped. Maybe humans have been static since the Eocene, says Wallace. I mean, for 50 million years, we now understand. He didn't know that then. Well, that's in some sense a hypothesis. Culture should have caused evolution to slow down. It was a really well-accepted hypothesis to the extent that people were saying other things about it. And so if we see changes in these populations in their skeleton, those changes must be brought on by the diets. They have to be growing differently because they're eating different foods. Or they have to be doing different things, and so that causes their skeleton to decline. That would be what we'd call a theory, something that was well-accepted enough that people were basing other stuff on it. In this case, the theory is wrong. The theory is wrong because it came from, because it came into contradiction with other sorts of stuff. More people means more opportunities for change. Changing environments means that the genes that were adapted to the environment before are no longer well adapted, so they ought to change. And that was my work, was sort of establishing this for humans. But I think you see how an idea, which makes sense, It becomes a hypothesis. There's not immediately data to test it or not, and so you start basing other stuff on it. That's the structure of scientific knowledge we're building. Sometimes those buildings come into conflict with each other. Sometimes they crash. But on the other hand, if a theory is tested from many different points of view and tends to survive, it's a very powerful theory. It could still be wrong. Newtonian theory was wrong about the motion of objects. But that doesn't mean it doesn't work. My daughter is learning Newton's three laws in science this week. Why? Because they work.
Scientific knowledge is becoming more and more specialized and fragmented, and that's one reason why people can't understand it. So I'm wondering what you think the opportunities are for more interdisciplinary cooperation and the kinds of simplification of knowledge into the stories that might be more appealing to the man on the street.
This is definitely the case in my area. We have in human genetics built very complicated mathematical models of the way that human populations should have interacted and changed over time. For most of those models, they're wrong in some way. And models are always wrong. In some cases, these models are really, really wrong. And wrong in ways that would be obvious to somebody who had broad knowledge of human history. For instance, when I talked about populations growing, some models that we use to understand human genetics predict that 3,000 years ago, the population of Earth was on the order of 10,000 people. That must be false. Somebody built the pyramids. It wasn't three people on their weekend time off. It was there were lots of people to do it. Now, the question is, from my point of view, the question is, what effect does this error have? And it's different depending on what kind of thing we're looking at. But from the standpoint of your question, what do we need to promote interdisciplinarity? Sometimes it doesn't take a lot. Sometimes it takes having somebody in your research group who's read some classical history or who has, perspectives from some other area. Somebody who's worked on digestion so that you're interested in the way that genes have changed in respect to diet evolution. Somebody who's worked on digestion is equipped to say, and when I see a gene expressed in small intestine, that means something. Or it doesn't mean something because that's well known to be expressed in all kinds of tissue types. So interdisciplinarity is really a difficult but essential part of today's science. Working with large teams that are spread across many different institutions has become central to making progress today. And that's something I think also that education needs to find ways to promote. How do you work together with other people, share rewards, share effort, when maybe the only way that you know them is through this project that you're working on? All right. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, Professor Hawks. Now is our time for Prairie's offering. Prairie runs on love, but we also need your monetary support. We invite you to share your gifts and offerings as the ushers pass the baskets. Aaron and Madeline will be performing our offertory music. Thank you. we'd like to welcome our guests and visitors this morning. If you are here for the first or second time or haven't attended for a while, we invite you to introduce yourself and share what brought you here this morning. Okay. Please take time to read the announcements on the order of service. Are there any other additional brief prairie announcements today? Kate? Oh, I'm sorry. Heidi?
On behalf of the Hospitality and Membership Committee, we'd just like to take a brief second, and I could have shared this with Joys and Concerns, but our joys are that people every month volunteer to do the jobs that they do as greeters and flower bringers and cleanup people. And we'd just like to say thank you to Dave Johnson and Gordon Cunningham for always making sure the coffee's here and hot in the morning. And for greeters like Rose Smith, who's always here to greet everyone with a smile, and also Rick and Paula and Rebecca Mulkey, and maybe some other people that are not on my list, and people that bring flowers this past month in January, Kim Trogg and Mary Franz, and also the people that are here to clean up every Sunday, usually Phoenix Wardell, and Gordon Cunningham, and also this month was Phyllis Long and Jim Carpenter and Ann Urbanski. We just like to say thank you, and we so appreciate this work because it makes Prairie run.
Well, I'll just piggyback on that. You'll probably notice that Kim, who hasn't been carrying the mic ever, carried the mic today, and she did a few other things. We're looking for a few more people like Kim who would volunteer to become what we call Sunday program assistants. And that means like getting the chalice out and the bell and being sure that there are programs, orders of service in all the various places. We do have Gordon Cunningham and Kate's kids and a few other people, Dave Johnson, seeing that part gets done. But it's a pretty easy job. You just have to learn how to do it, and we need more of you so that the program coordinators like myself don't have to do it.
I got to thinking it's really close to the time that we should be burning our little prairie garden here. We can start planning on burning it anytime from late March through April, but not later. So Ken Skog is here, and Ken has the permit, the license or something rather from the city, so we're going to get together on making plans, but we'd like to do it on a Sunday and get children in, at least out there to observe it. Small children need to be watched, but larger children, like people are, maybe can help with it. So we'll be in touch with you on that.
Okay, I just want to make a quick reminder about the fact that the service auction is coming up, and we need more items. So if you haven't submitted your item, or if you would like some ideas, or there's something that you would like to request, please let me know. I'm Kate. I'm the administrator. All of the previous stuff about the service auction has said to submit your ideas to Barb Park, who is our finance chair, but she's going to be out of town for a while, so I'm going to take over collecting those items. So please send things in to me.
On behalf of the Long Range Planning Committee, we had a workshop last month on ministerial relationships, and I know there were a number of people who were not able to attend, so we're thinking of having a short, compressed version of that information presented after service on the 21st. Could I have a show of hands of members who were not able to come to the January meeting? Okay, and of those, could you keep your hand up if you think you might be able to come to a 1 hour or less meeting after the service on the 21st? Okay, well, it looks like we'd have a small group. Thank you very much.
This is the first day of Mystery Friends. So if you guys have letters for some of the children downstairs, I'm still needing a couple more for the kids down there, and they're really excited. So if you have your letter, please get it to me, and I have letters to hand out to people. If you did forget to bring your letter, let me know, and I'll make sure to have it mailed out this week to the child. And our party will be on March 7th downstairs after the service from 11:30 to about noon or so. And Wild Wintering is coming up February 20th to the 21st. So if your child is able to make it, please email me so I have a head count started. And very quickly, I wanted to just say that on February 21st, the service will be on Transcendental Meditation. And it's an author of a book called The Maharishi Effect, who's... he lives in DeForest. He works here in Madison. He wrote a book called The Maharishi Effect and His Life in the Movement back in the 70s. And he will be here speaking. So if anyone is interested, he has the book. It's at the library. I can get you the title, but you might want to read it beforehand. It's a really interesting book. I do have a copy if anybody wants to borrow it.
Okay, thanks. It's time to sing. Let's join in our last song, one of my favorites, Life is the Greatest Gift of All, song number 331. Please stand. Our closing words today are from John Brigham. Go your ways, knowing not the answers to all things, yet seeking always the answer to one more thing than you know. Thank you for coming. While we engage in conversation and coffee, Madeline and Aaron will provide some lovely background music for our enjoyment. Please stay and welcome your neighbor.